Good morning. My name is Michael McCusker. I dedicate today's program to the Equal Rights Amendment and its necessary revival, not only for women who inspired it, but for all of us. I start with something I've written. When patriots are traitors. Dr. Samuel Johnson is famous for his witticisms, such as, "Nothing so concentrates a man's mind than knowing he will be hanged in the morning." But one he is most noted for, that patriotism is the last refuge of a scoundrel, has many critics, notably among them Ambrose Bierce, author of the famously infamous The Devil's Dictionary. Bierce said that although he did not wish to contradict Dr. Johnson, he felt patriotism to be a scoundrel's first refuge. An enduring measure of hothouse patriotism is to not ask uncomfortable questions of leaders who usually equate such inquiries as very unpatriotic. Unquestioning support and obedience are usually regarded as super patriotism. This is the type of patriotism currently being urged on the American people by its president, Donald Trump, especially in the wake of his perceived collusion with Russian manipulation in favor of his election. Trump and his vaunted base of ultra-right-wing white supremacist nationalists are exploiting his unexpected presidency to coerce Americans into thinking it is unpatriotic to defend or protect political rights and civil liberties. And in the meantime, these misogynist Morlocks go about dismantling the basic fundamentals of democratic governance. Many Americans claim they are willing to give up certain freedoms in a crisis, but none should overlook or trust those who are ready to curtail liberty and freedom at any excuse, not temporarily as implied, but permanently. We are a democracy because it is necessary. It is not because of altruistic human nature that we have inherited a few basic rights and liberties sought by the mass of humanity for millennia. The limits on power that Trump intends to abolish were established precisely to curb the avaricious ambitions of many among us, like Trump, to prevent them from getting their hands on our constitutional rights. Our freedoms are, in essence, our obligations as well, to preserve them for our descendants. Yet the farther removed we are from the intense imperatives of our ancestors for freedom and equality, the more we dangerously take for granted what they fought to establish, and the greater the probability we will carelessly allow them to be seized from us. The current fervor for nationalistic patriotism disavows patriotic dissent against its zealous xenophobia and declaims it as fake. Yet now is the essential moment to resist, to question with intelligent and vigorous skepticism the preposterous claims that curtailment of civil liberties is a necessity to the nation's survival, as well as the incitement of racial prejudice. This populist resistance to contraband repression is precisely what our revolutionary ancestors had in mind when they set up our imperfect but earnest Constitution and its Ten Commandments of American democracy. The ancestors anticipated critical moments of great tragedy, anxiety, and even betrayal, such as now, and they realized unscrupulous persons would seize the opportunity to grasp power and dismantle the Constitution. The unprincipled president and his hard right and all-white cabal of corporate Tories and nouveau Nazis are quite probably the people our venerated ancestors tried to warn us against and attempted to prevent their usurpation of power with constitutional government and separation of powers, and of course, with the Bill of Rights that clearly and concisely spell out the rights and obligations of the people. The issue is not whether the American people think it is a good idea to deny or abrogate certain civil liberties, but whether a president can make war on the Constitution and unilaterally dismember American democracy. We are a democracy, yet we know little about democracy. Liberty, independence, and equal rights do not come easily and never stay very long without constant nurturing. Democracy is a battleground of human emotion and disparity. Freedom has not been an easy achievement, nor equal justice any other than an eternal combat between those who would expand rights and liberties and those who would limit or abolish them altogether. And democracy, as a result of its disparity, is always a factional dispute between humans who believe they deserve freedom, but others do not, and those who believe in universal emancipation. The USA probably should, as so many suggest, refresh itself in this dark period of crises, uncertainty, and retrogression with a fresh infusion of original principles. But these are difficult to pin down and incredibly problematic to apply to an evolving millennial society. The Bill of Rights and subsequent amendments clarify that original intent of the Constitution was not as restricted as many so-called strict constructionists claim, but instead as originally constructed, an amendable document able to reflect and serve a continually changing civilization despite the hardships, frustrations, and bloodshed that accompany the amending process. The original framers had at least the foresight to recognize that the interests and problems of succeeding generations would most certainly be different than their own. The endless cycle of individual rights and obligations meshed within collective necessities is distinctly at play in this period of trauma and crises. It is a time to confront and attempt to comprehend at their core the most cherished vanities, the theories, philosophies, and moral roots of our civilization at their most vulnerable levels. In particular, the faltering ethos that the wishes of the citizens are the mandate of democratic governance. Bewildered, exhausted, and despaired by the cold realities and complexities of contemporary government and its unholy alliance with wealth and military force, perhaps we should adhere to parsimony instead of surrender. Patiently trace the confused, corrupt tentacles to their origins, and from that basic point, realize how we got off the track of history we intended to navigate when our ancestors stoutly declared they could no longer abide the oppressions of a king. If we wish to take hope and some encouragement in the long struggle ahead to right the balance of power in this country, perhaps it is not too late to agree with James Boyle, who wrote, "One reason we have a democracy is because people make unspeakably stupid decisions without it." And that was something I wrote. When patriots are traitors. And now, after a war is lost, which is written by George Kaiser and translated by Kevin Violet. Its real title in German would be Nach einem verlorenen Krieg, in my very bad pronunciation of German. After a war is lost, when starvation and degradation rule and all values are sold down the river, a bunco artist sees his chance. He senses, because he is himself filled with basic instincts, that he can rule everyone if he promises them a way out of the hopeless situation. And so he promises the moon if they will follow and obey. And this folk that has lost everything and sees no way out believes in its dullness his empty rant, which bespeaks not the good of the many, but only his own lust to power, to rule. At first, the number of believers is small, but the shriek and hubbub grows ever louder, the lying promises ever more audacious and cunning, uncontrolled and uncontrollable. Those who have nothing to lose, who do not want to think or analyze, follow the siren song of the seducer, which leads to ruin. Giddy with hunger, deafened by the tumult of the masses, driven by the longing for peace and freedom, they scream for that which they crave. The great scoundrel has reached his goal. Now he presses those who were deceived by his lies into a tortured mass, which he exploits and toys with. His sadism drives him to have a prison built next to his palace so that he can hear the chains rattle. The groaning and bleating of the prisoners is music to him. Now he has the power over life and death. And every day, while the mass hungers and suffers, a truck crosses the prison yard to his palace, laden with luxuries of food and drink. His tongue is strengthened with bonbons to tell sweet lies, which must remain unfulfilled. But slowly the folk realize that none of the promises have come true. Their awakening is strongly repressed, but the number of unbelievers grows swiftly. A whisper campaign begins. A plan is formed, a plan to cast down the deceiver. One day the truck is wrecked and the sweetmeats are spilled on the streets for all the hungry to see. The signal is given. A few prisoners succeed in wrenching loose from their chains. Soon the guards are overpowered and the palace stormed. The mob rushes in, intent on vengeance. The object of their rage thinks quickly. He is far too cowardly to face the consequences of his misdeeds, and he flees through a secret tunnel to his prison. He changes his hair and beard just enough to deceive the casual glance. He cunningly chains himself to an iron ring and then cries to be freed. Upon his release, he storms ahead of the mob, screaming for the blood of the tyrant himself. He promises that he will free the people from their bondage, and again no one notices his deception. He leads them on in search of himself, and jubilantly they follow the very one they wish to destroy. He mocks and reviles the cowardly tyrant who has flown from them. He puts a price on his own head and becomes a hero of the revolution. The folk willingly follow him and do not learn that they have been deceived. And he amuses himself before his expensive mirror, trying out new faces to deceive the folk. What shall he be this time? A reporter who earns money writing muckraking exposés of himself? Or perhaps a movie star? But no, he has a better plan. He becomes a holy man, a man of God. Fasting and praying, he lives in a hut in the woods, and the folk he betrayed, whom no earthly power can help, make the pilgrimage to him, the demigod. The ultimate victory is his. He can promise that which he cannot fulfill and be prayed to. And that was After a War is Lost, written by George Kaiser, who was born in Magdeburg, Germany in 1878. He lived in Buenos Aires from 1898 to 1901. In 1921, he abandoned a career as a merchant to become a freelance writer. In 1933, his books were banned by the Nazis, and in 1938, he fled to Switzerland, where he died in 1945. And Kevin Violette, who translated After the War is Lost, is a third-generation Oregonian of French-Canadian descent. He was raised in Garibaldi and worked for a number of years on his father's commercial fishing boat. He spent a year in Germany, where he studied for a teacher's degree to teach German and Spanish. He is a member of the famous Astoria rock band, the Pagan Pancakes, and an original broadcaster for KMUN. And a very good friend of mine. And now, Oh Dear God, Please Help Us to Kill Them, by Stephanie Salter. As political satires go, it is a dark and brutal one that begins on a deceptively positive note. It was a time of great excitement. The country was up in arms. The war was on. In every breast burned the holy fire of patriotism. The place was the United States. the Time, 1904 to 1905, and the author was Samuel L. Clemens, by then known around the world as Mark Twain. In a very short story called The War Prayer, Clemens draws his unsuspecting reader in with a rousing account of a nation passionately headed off to war. Sunday morning came, the church was filled, with the volunteers set their dear ones, proud, happy, and envied by the neighbors and friends who had no sons and brothers to send forth to the field of honor, there to win for the flag, or failing, die the noblest of noble deaths. Led by a pastor, Clemens imagined congregation praise to an ever-merciful and benignant Father of us all, quote unquote, to watch, aid, comfort, bless, and shield our noble young soldiers and make them strong and confident, invincible in the bloody onset, help them to crush the foe, grant to them and to their flag and country imperishable honor and glory. Then Clemens eviscerates his reader with what he later told a friend was the whole truth. In the person of a messenger from God, an aged stranger, his long body clothed in a robe that reached to his feet, his seamy face unnaturally pale, pale even to ghastliness, the total reality of the people's prayers for victory is revealed. It is a reality few of us ever face, yet alone accept. Listen, the stranger commands. O Lord, our God, help us to tear their soldiers to bloody shreds with our shells. Help us to cover their smiling fields with the pale forms of their patriot dead. Help us to drown the thunder of the guns with the shrieks of their wounded, writhing in pain. Help us to lay waste their humble homes with a hurricane of fire. Help us to wring the hearts of their unoffending widows with unavailing grief. Help us to turn them out roofless with their little children to wander unfriended the wastes of their desolated land in rags and hunger and thirst. Sports of the sun, flames of summer and the icy winds of winter, broken in spirit, worn with travail, imploring thee for the refuge of the grave and denied it. For our sakes who adore thee, Lord, blast their hopes, blight their lives, protract their bitter pilgrimage, make heavy their steps, water their way with their tears, stain the white snow with the blood of their wounded feet. The messenger finishes by asking for all of this in the spirit of him who is the source of love and who is the ever faithful refuge and friend of all that are sore beset and seek his aid with humble and contrite hearts. Amen. Driving the final nail of irony, Clemens closes the grim parable with the messenger demanding to know whether the congregation still desires its prayers to be answered. But no one speaks. The last sentence of the story explains, it was believed afterward that the man was a lunatic because there was no sense in what he said. Accustomed to criticism, despite his literary success, Clemens insisted on keeping the War Prayer unpublished until after his death in 1910. As his first biographer, Albert Bigelow Payne, noted in 1912, Clemens confided his reasoning to a friend. Only dead men can tell the truth in this world. In the century since it was written, the War Prayer has been invoked by pacifists during several conflicts in which the United States has been engaged. Its last major renaissance was the Vietnam War. With the memory of that landscape and those people, with the visions of millions of besieged Afghan children, women, and men, this seems as good a time as any for yet another reading. And that was, O Dear God, Please Help Us to Kill Them, by Stephanie Salter, who at the time she wrote it was a columnist for the San Francisco Chronicle, from which this had been reprinted in the North Coast Times-Eagle. And now, I'd like to read a bit of an epilogue. As I record today's program in advance, I have not heard the results of Donald Trump's first formal White House physical exam as president. Of course, the real test would be his mental state, perhaps even the state of his soul, especially that part that darkens the sun, so to speak, not to mention his seeming obliviousness to starting a nuclear war with peoples of non-white skins. Yet amidst the anxious swirling controversies about his sanity and mental derelictions, there is no mention of the plausible possibility that he might be a late-stage syphilitic. After all, he prides himself as the playboy of the Western world and brags about his irresistible sexuality. He has certainly hinted of his previously open solicitation of call girls, the upper class constituency of prostitutes. And the young women of his beauty pageants were more truly his personal harems, at least in his own mind. Even the Russians seem to know their man, offering him hotel sex, if the rumors are not fake news. Trump exhibits late syphilitic tendencies, known as the tertiary period, which more often occurs years after the initial infection. Physical symptoms aside, this final and ultimately fatal syndrome is manifest with serious mental and nervous system disorder. Trump is increasingly displaying erratic, compulsive, even psychotic behavior, which could be an explanation for his amplified, swinish xenophobia. And now I would like to read a poem by Jim Dott, who every year around the new year sends a new poem that he had just written. This one is called Whale Song. Born in water, you whales must have no fear of drowning, no words for it. Your long journey toward birth spent swimming in a sea within a sea, first breath drawn while buoyed up by Mother Ocean. If your music has words, do you sing dark ballads of the killing time, of harpoons rammed through blubber, ripping into muscle, of blood slicks, screams sounding off the bottom, of years without song? Our bruising hulls, our smears of oil now cross and crowd your routes, our ship props, sonar blips, overwhelm your solos, drown out duets, obscure choruses, still you sing. What are whales' fears? Do you sing of them? Is it us? Or being shoved off course and beached, succumbing to the crush of your own weight on heart and lungs? Do you have a song that dives down and down into a deep blue moan? Our bodies, your souls, doomed to be the feed for dusky sharks or eels or killer whales or crabs, for your empty guilt or your precious greed, or worms, or worms, or worms. Or maybe I have it wrong and there are no words at all, only music to swim in, dive through, float on, only music to gather you, lift you to breathe, only music, born by water. And that was Whale Song by Jim Dott. And he wrote it in December 2017. Well, a magical outcome of a government shutdown, if it does happen, would be that when the lights come back on and the doors reopen, Trump and his trolls will have vanished into the know-nothingness they emerged from. If you are willing and find it possible, join a women's march on Saturday. There is probably one near you. This is Michael McCusker.